Marini's Media.
What a weekend in the EFL. Worldies all over the country. Adam Armstrong, feet stronger, and Neil Warnock works out how to unmute himself on Zoom. Scenes. This is the Totally Football League show in association with Paddy Power. Hey gang, hope you're well. Matt Davis Adams here to talk you through another wacky weekend in the English Football League. Sam Parkin's off this week, but the former Arsenal, Stevenage, Southend and Moor winger Adrian Clarke is here. Hello, Clarke.
Hello, Matt. Good to be back.
Also on board, long-time friend of the show, one of the voices of the EFL on Quest, as well as Soccer Saturday and more, keeping up the quota of Oxford United supporters on the pod, it's Simon Watts. Hi, Simon.
How you doing?
Very well, thank you. And making her Totally Football League show debut from BBC London, the QPR podcast and Football Weekly. Never heard of it, mate. A big hello to Flo Lloyd-Hughes.
Hello, hello. Yeah, and you've already hinted that I do far too many podcasts. So apologies to some people who may have already heard me on about five this week already. But here you go.
Yeah, might as well chuck you on another one. Can't do any harm. Enough with the pleasantries. On with the product placement.
Paddy Power's Performance of the Weekend.
Yes, it's time for Paddy Power's Performance of the Weekend, a format device which allows the show's principal sponsor to gain additional exposure in the guise of an EFL-related feature. Basically, we all get 15 seconds to say why we think a team should earn the title of the Paddy Power Performance of the Weekend. We put it out on Twitter and you vote for your favourite. Last week, I/Harrogate won, which is good because Lord knows I've not been whiffing the sweet scent of victory from my own football team for some time now. Our panel have made their selections. Producer Abby will hit the gong sound effect once the time limit is reached. Clarkie, you're the veteran of this game, so you've got the honour of going first. You have selected Woo-hoo. Cambridge United. Your 15 seconds start now.
Yeah, it shouldn't even be up for debate. Cambridge on fire under Mark Bonnett. Blew Morecambe away with a 5-0 win. Three worldies, including one from Wes Houlihan, which was nice. 560-mile round trip, 20 shots on goal. Their keeper had just one.
That was pretty good, actually. I think you just about did
that,
it.
That gong really made me jump. I actually just jumped out of my chair. That scared me.
All right, Flo, you've picked Wimbledon. You can go next and just be aware there will be a gong 15 seconds from now.
I know, I needed a warning. Yeah, mad performance from Wimbledon. I was there at Loftus Road, their temporary second home. And for a team that last season did struggle to score goals at times, I couldn't believe what I was watching when they bagged four. Coming from behind twice, managed to pull it. Oh. That was not good.
Good first effort and room for improvement. Simon, let's see how you get on. You've chosen Luton Town.
Well, opposition, including Wayne Rooney and Andre Wisdom, the big names of Derby County. Luton's low-budget squad, including the likes of Jordan Clark from Accrington, who hit the winner. Now 7 wins in 9 going back to last season. When you consider Derby had Jack Marriott, £5 million former. Just as I was getting into second gear.
I can't believe your name.
Credit to Luton as well.
I can't believe your name checking Andre Wisdom as some kind of big fish alongside Wayne Rooney. He's got to be happy with that.
Yeah, well, you know, he did play for Liverpool a couple of times, didn't he?
And Derby did look toothless at the weekend, some might say. Okay, I've gone for Stevenage. Let's see if I can make it 2 from 2 on the Twitter poll. Here I go. So Stevenage beat Oldham 3-0. They only scored 3 or more goals in one game in the whole of last season. They thought they'd be out of the EFL, but they looked to be making the most of their reprieve. Dominated this game, 20 shots at goal, 12 on target to Oldham's 1, and they've got as many points after 2 out of the 10 last. I can go over the time a bit because I'm the host. All right, get on Twitter at the Totally Show to cast your vote. Adrian's chosen Cambridge, Flo's gone for Wimbledon, Simon's gone for Luton, and I went for Stevenage. We'll get to the weekend's action promptly, but it being 2020, there is some COVID-related news to discuss. A report in the Daily Mail last week highlighted that EFL clubs no longer required to undertake mandatory coronavirus testing on their players and staff, except where someone is displaying symptoms of the virus or after an international break in the Championship, with League One and Two clubs needing to test if a player has been away with their country or been given an extended period of time off. The article states that the test costs between 100 and £150 each, and that the weekly bill can be as much as £30,000 if 100 employees are checked prior to two matches. So as with a lot of things COVID-related, it comes down to economics versus safety. Adrian, what's your take on this?
Well, it seems very risky to me. I do understand the financial implications. I hope, really, this is some kind of play from the EFL and EFL clubs to get somebody to effectively sponsor these tests or to, you know, to subsidise them, because it is a prohibitive cost for many of these teams. But I just don't see how you can go into matches not knowing if half your team's got COVID or not. I think this is, you know, suddenly they could become breeding grounds for the virus, and that just goes against everything that we've worked towards over the summer. So something's got to give here. I get it, but it seems risky. Hopefully somebody will be able to subsidise the costs.
Flo, is it naive to think that it should be the EFL footing the bill for this?
Well, when I compare it to women's football, which I cover a lot too, obviously the FA is the one footing the bill for that, and they're a governing body. Obviously EFL's a little bit different, but I agree, I think it is a little bit risky, and I don't want to be a snitch, but on Saturday, neither Plymouth or Wimbledon's subs were even wearing masks, really. So I think perhaps with everything going on around us and the cases that are rising across the country, it is a little bit of a risk to now take this away. Maybe about a month ago, when things had stabilised a bit, it would have made a bit more sense, and there was week on week of no results in the league. But I think now it does seem a bit risky to suddenly say, oh, there's going to be no testing unless there's an international break and you've got internationals or symptoms or whatever it may be. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if things kind of unravel quite quickly. But if it is a tactical play, like Adrian said, and it's a sort of, you know, cry for help, then maybe someone will come along and say, oh, we'll cover it then.
What do you think, Simon? Do you think it might take a case that, like Clarkie's alluded to, that you might get one club with loads of positive tests after a match for the EFL, or for somebody to sit up and take notice and say, OK, we'll pay for it?
Well, you would imagine the chances of that happening are very, very high, wouldn't you? And I mean, these players are no different to the rest of us. They've got families, they've got relatives, elderly relatives they're going to be coming into contact with when you're man-to-man marking in games and training every day, not to mention the staff and people who work within the training grounds on a daily basis as well, who will be in contact with them. So it creates a massive dilemma for the players. And I know I spoke to a lot of players in the summer about the return to football and how they were feeling about that. And without testing, they were very, very reluctant to come back. And we're a lot further down the line now on the one hand, but on the other, you know, this is a problem that heading into the winter, as we well know, and it's not like these players are going to be quarantined in between matches, then, you know, they're going to be in the general public, potentially mixing with people. I just think it's a disaster waiting to happen, really.
And literally, as we're talking about that, Adrian, we get news coming out of Leighton Orient.
Yeah, just got on one of my news apps. It says that several Leighton Orient players have tested positive for COVID, and that now means that their cup game against Spurs is potentially in doubt. So there you go. this could be a precursor for many things to come. And what Simon said is very relevant. There might be some players out there that are shielding elderly relatives or you know, partners that have underlying health conditions. If they suddenly start withdrawing from matches because there are no testing, surely that will force the hand so that the widespread testing can continue.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what's not depressing, brackets, unless you support Nottingham Forest, close brackets, football. Let's talk about that next.
For the rest of this month being September 2020, you can take out a subscription to The Athletic for the frankly ridiculous price of just £1 a month. That's unrivaled football writing and analysis from the very best people in the business, a brand spanking new breaking news service, and ad-free versions of each Athletic podcast, all for just £1 a month. Go to theathletic.com/leagueshow to get started.
You're listening to the Totally Football League Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Championship headlines. Some supporters were back in some stadiums, specifically in the Championship at Middlesbrough and Norwich. Speaking of the Canaries, Max Ahrens won't be going to Barcelona after a deal to take him from Carrow Road to Catalunya fell through. Elsewhere, Neil Warnock zoomed into the Riverside to salvage a draw against Bournemouth. Forest and Derby lost again, but Bristol City, Luton and Reading are 2-2. And we're going to start our look back on the weekend at Ewood Park, where Blackburn dished out a 5-0 gubbing to Wickham in the first ever competitive meeting between the sides. Tony Mowbray with the most backhanded of compliments to the chairboys post-match, saying, "I knew they'd be difficult to play against, as it was for the first 10 minutes. Adam Armstrong hit a hat-trick here. Flo, where does he rank among the Championship's top strikers? Because it felt like he went a little bit under the radar last season, despite getting 16 league goals for a fairly middling side.
Yeah, he's definitely up there, and I know there are a couple of eyes on him, but I think because he's not one of the showy players in the league, he probably doesn't grab as much attention. And I think Rovers fans also are a bit disappointed in how the team finished last year in terms of league position, so maybe that's kind of covered things up a little bit. But if they carry on this form and do finish highly as well, then you'd think a lot of people would be interested in him, especially potentially in January if he doesn't leave before the transfer window closes. But definitely one of the best strikers in the league at the moment, and there's not a lot of top striking talent at the moment, so players like him do stand out, and so many top-end Championship clubs or Premier League clubs are looking for those kind of bargains. And when clubs like Brentford are constantly turning over talent, he's the kind of person that clubs in that sort of area will look to as a maybe fairly reasonably priced player who's going to grab you, at least double digits every season.
Somebody else who stood out in that game, Adrian, Tyrese Dolan, 18 years old, won a penalty and scored on his full league debut. This after he was released by Preston in the summer. That's good scouting from Rovers, isn't it?
It is good scouting, and it goes to show that one opinion doesn't necessarily mean it's a deal breaker for players. I think when some players get released by a club, they get so down on themselves and they lose all confidence and they disappear without trace. But obviously what Tyrese has done, he's picked himself up and maybe sorted himself out with a move and put some feelers out himself, and fair play to Blackburn for identifying him and giving him a chance. He looked really lively to me. I mean, little pocket rocket, great celebration as well, wasn't it? He had the old somersault going on, didn't he? So no, he'll be buzzing, assist, a goal, and I'm led to believe that the players themselves at Blackburn identified him during pre-season and were saying to Tony Mowbray, "We've got to get this kid involved in the first team. This kid's electric. He's done that. He's listened to the players. He's used them as judges, and it looks like Rovers are benefiting."
In terms of Wickham, Simon, we've got a lot of love for them on this pod. I'm guessing maybe you're not quite as affectionate toward them, given what happened in the playoff final with your beloved Oxford. Not many people giving Wickham much of a chance of staying in the Championship for a second season. This was obviously a harsh lesson, but are there any positives you can see for them going forward?
Not on the evidence of this game, but I have to say that, Wickham are one of these teams who thrive when they've been written off. I think they will come again. They're just finding their feet. And I don't think you can underestimate, you look at Oxford's poor start to the season as well. The fact that they have had a much, much shorter pre-season to get ready for this. Okay, you could say Championship clubs are all playing, I suppose, to mid-July as well. But, for a club to adjust going up such a big jump into a new division, I think it was always going to be a tough baptism for them. But I do think they've got the spirit and togetherness within the football club, which will hopefully for them shine through, come the latter stages of the season. I certainly don't hold that playoff final against them, really. But just on Tyrese Dolan as well, by the way, I was reading up on him and he actually caught Blackburn's eye in an FA Youth Cup match playing for Preston last season and turned down moves to Carlisle and Fleetwood in the summer. He basically said that him and his agent had already made a decision that he wasn't going to have much of a pathway at Preston in the summer. And I think it was quite a close call on whether they were going to offer him a new deal or not. But because of the COVID situation, they decided to cut a few youngsters loose that may well have otherwise been offered new contracts. But he was effectively saying that if he had been offered a new deal by Preston, he'd already made that decision that he was going to step away and try and find a club that was a better fit in terms of getting into first team football, which is quite a brave move, but also shows a massive sign of confidence for an 18-year-old. But what a bit of business for Blackburn as well, because with the salary cap this year, he comes under that. So it's effectively a free player in your squad.
Yeah, looks like one that's going to work out for everybody. Elsewhere, Middlesbrough 1, Bournemouth 1 at the Riverside. Neil Warnock watching via Zoom, RIP Skype. that from home after he tested positive for COVID. His assistant Kevin Blackwell said afterwards that Warnock is well, which is good news. Dominic Solanke rather generously credited with the opening goal. And then, let's have a look at Brony, said Warnock before authorising the arrival from the bench of goal scorer Marcus Brown. Marcus Brown with the goal, but another forward has been added to the Middlesbrough ranks in Chuba Akpom. What can you tell us about him, Adrian, from what you saw of him at his time at Arsenal?
Yeah, I saw plenty of him. He's knocking on the door for a long, long time at Arsenal. He came through a little bit like Eddie Nketiah has done this, well, across last season. He was the next big thing. It didn't quite happen for him. What he did, he went out on loan to a number of clubs in the Championship, and he didn't score prolifically. And for that reason, when he came back, he seemed further away from the first team than he was initially. And in the end, they cut him free. He's come from Greek football, PAOK, where he was brilliant by all accounts. Wasn't prolific. Around one goal in five games, sometimes on the bench as well. But they liked him. He's a good team player. He's quick. He's strong. He's a decent enough finisher. But I have to say, initially, I would expect him to be back up at the Riverside to Asamoah Longa and Fletch. Obviously, you've got Brown in there as well. That's part of the group of front men. So yeah, he's just adding competition for places. Yeah, but he's 24 as well now. So coming into his prime, look, he could turn out to be a gem, but I don't think he'll be topping the goal charts this season.
On Middlesbrough generally, Flo, what kind of expectations should we have around them this season? Obviously, it didn't work out for Jonathan Woodgate. Neil Warnock's made some new signings, but the bulk of the squad from last year is still there. Would it be realistic to expect a promotion challenge?
I think a promotion challenge is a bit beyond them, but I think they're going to be hard to beat because they're on Neil Warnock's side and his side's always hard to beat. I don't think they're going to play the most attractive football, but that won't really matter because the fans had a pretty rubbish time last season anyway. So I think anything better than last season is a positive, and he will galvanise the fan base because he's that sort of personality. Everyone will hate them. All the other fans in the league will hate Warnock, but that will only build that loyalty and that following. I am maybe a little bit worried about where this is coming in Warnock's career, because it seemed like he was kind of happy retiring in Cornwall, and obviously he's what, 71 now, and it's whether he is really up for the challenge and really committed to potentially stay here for a couple of years and build something towards promotion. And that's the only thing. Obviously Borough want to get back up as soon as possible, and I don't really know if he's going to be the one to do that, but he, you know, his record will be good there. It's just beyond, you know, a mid-table for a finish that's perhaps pushing for the playoffs. I don't know what they can offer.
Simon, he's just a football addict, isn't he, basically? There's no need for a 71-year-old to be travelling literally the length of the country to go to work all the time.
No, but he surrounds himself with people he knows and trusts as well. Ronnie Jepson, Kevin Blackwell, you saw on the touchline at the weekend, and he's very good at empowering people, designating responsibility as well. I mean, players who've played under Neil Warnock have said you often won't see him on the training ground until Thursday, Friday, which as a fan I found a little bit strange. But then when you speak to players, actually, and I don't know, Adrian might have experienced this in his career, actually that sometimes has more of an impact when the boss turns up on Thursday, because that's when you start to get your game face on. By the way, I was absolutely gutted to see Marcus Brown score on Saturday, because from my understanding, a deal for him to come back to Oxford was potentially on the table. He was brilliant on loan with us last season, as he was from West Ham, but I genuinely think he is such a good player and a good prospect. It needs somebody like Neil Warnock to show a little bit of faith in him, because I think that move to the northeast from London last year was maybe a little bit difficult for him to adjust, particularly in a struggling team under Jonathan Woodgate. But I think that, you know, in Marcus Brown, they have a player there who will be like a new signing if they can get him in a good headspace this season.
Well, Luton Town continued their winning start to the season by beating Derby at Kenilworth Road. Nick Miller was there for The Athletic. He joins us now. Nick, this was your first experience of a live game during the pandemic. How did you find it?
It was odd, but sort of strangely comforting as well. Maybe it was nice for me to, you know, go to Luton relatively gentle surroundings, and they seem to, everything seemed to be sort of arranged very well, you know, lots of room, everyone in masks and so on, but it was kind of, it did feel, I mean, it feels a bit weird, still feels a bit weird being out of the house, never mind going to Luton to watch a football game. But yeah, it was strangely comforting.
And this was one of the games that could potentially have had spectators. Luton were offered the chance to let 1,000 fans in, but declined to do so. Did you get much of a steer on why they did turn it down?
I think it was just the reasons that they outlined in their statement, that they basically didn't have enough time to make arrangements. I couldn't quite decide whether Kenilworth Road would be the best or the worst ground to have this kind of event at, because on the one hand, you can only get into the place via a couple of from two directions. So from that perspective, it would be quite easy to sort of funnel people out without pointing them in the right direction, without having people mixing and going all over the place. But on the other hand, it's incredibly cramped ground. It's obviously very old and rickety, and the concourses are quite narrow. So I don't know. Maybe they just stuck their hand up and then thought about it for a second and thought, oh, no, actually, this would be a really stupid idea. Because, I mean, last week on the Extra Time show, George and Ali had the Shrewsbury chief executive on, and they have kind of, I think it's like 40 acres around the site, so that there's lots of room for people to spread out and so on. But Kenilworth Road, that's not possible. So I don't know whether they're planning to sort of put their hand up again if as perhaps looks quite unlikely now, there are more of these test events, but you know, who knows.
Nick, what of the performances then? You know that I'm completely unconvinced by Cocu, and that I'm sure that Wayne Rooney will be Derby manager before the end of this season, but we'll get to that point some point in the future, I'm sure. What about Derby's performance? I did read that they were slightly better than they were against Reading. A couple of debutants, weren't there? Joswiak and Nathan Byrne. Did either of those two catch the eye?
Yeah, Joswiak was pretty good in the second half. I mean, I think he said before when he signed that he prefers playing on the left, so it was quite odd that he started on the right-hand side. He just seemed to spend most of the first half standing on the touchline watching big diagonals gently sort of sail over his head. But then there was a few sort of tactical switches, and he went out to the left and was much more effective, cutting in on his right foot and set up the goal with a very sort of smart little kind of turn and flick back to Jack Marriott. It did cross my mind to ask Cocu after the game, you know, do you think you'll be gone soon and Wayne Rooney will come in? But, you know, he's actually quite a big lad, so I decided against that one.
Nick, what was from what you could gather, what was the vibes amongst the team, the coaching staff and the squad? Were they looking quite negative, heads down? I mean, I feel like that's the first sign of things falling apart and a manager soon to be out the door.
I didn't notice anything particularly negative in that respect. They were quite agitated for parts of the game. The team, in terms of the team performance, certainly in the first half, they were incredibly flat. As Matt said a minute ago, they were better than against Reading, but that, you know, is a fairly low bar to jump over. So it just seemed to be a sort of a bit of a microcosm of Cocu's time there. There was a lot of frustrating things, and seemed to be making the same mistakes as they have been doing for the past year, but with enough little nuggets of hope that you might think, well, give him a bit of time and he'll figure this out.
Whilst we've got you, Nick, I'm being forced by producer Abby to ask you about the two-time European champions Nottingham Forest. Firstly, they've lost a club legend and under-23 coach to Luton. Tell us more about that after answering the question, you okay, hun?
Yeah, I mean, Chris Cohen was sat behind me. He was sat a few rows behind me at Luton, and I sort of very naively thought, oh, Forest are playing Derby in 3 or 4 weeks' time, maybe he's just scouting. But then after the game, after the press conferences had been done, who should I see but Chris Cohen having his photograph taken on the pitch with a Luton shirt, and my keen journalistic instincts kicked in and thought, I smell a rat here. But yeah, it is as a Forest fan, Cohen leaving sort of made me much sadder than the collapse at the end of last season did, because that was, you know, it was just not getting in the playoffs. You know, that'll happen again. that particular disappointment will happen again. It's happened before, and we probably will get in the playoffs at some point. So, you know, as catastrophic as that was, this didn't really affect me as much as this, weirdly, because Forest, well, and any club the size of Forest don't really have current heroes or legends anymore, because as soon as they're good enough for someone else to buy them, someone else buys them. Chris Cowan stayed, has been with Forest for 13 odd years. He has sort of stayed through three cruciate ligament injuries. He was coaching the youth team with Andy Reid, which was just, if nothing else, incredibly comforting. And when you support a team that are largely terrible for most of the time, comforting things like that are almost the best you can hope for.
Can I just say, Chris Cowan is a good mate of Nathan Jones. They go way back. I think they spent a couple of seasons together at Yeovil, and I vaguely remember Nathan speaking highly about Chris to me as a player. You know, we've got a lad here that's really, really good, too good for this level. And of course, he ended up going to Nottingham Forest. So that connection makes sense.
Yeah, Cowan's always, even when he was a player, he felt like a coach who was just sort of waiting to become a coach. He just had that sort of, you know, very professional and authoritative air. And yeah, as you said, I think when Cowan joined Yeovil from West Ham when he was quite young, I think Nathan Jones took him under his wing a little bit. And clearly they've sort of stayed in touch and been close ever since.
So Cohen won't be taking caretaker charge of Forest if/when Sabri Lamouchi gets the Spanish Archer. How close do you think we are to that after the home defeat to Cardiff on Saturday?
Who knows? I mean, I was actually a little bit surprised that I didn't emerge from Kenilworth Road on Saturday to the news that Lamouchi had gone. I mean, I don't know. I can only sort of sigh and shrug at this stage. Forest are supposedly signing or in talks to sign Scott McKenna, big centre-back from Aberdeen, which will be, you know what, I've lost count of the number of players that Forest have signed. The thing is that you can make sort of individual cases for most of the players that Forest have signed. Like, for example, Cyrus Christie joined at the back end of last week. And, you know, he's probably better than Carl Jenkinson or, you know, Dariqua, who or the other right-back options we have. But that's now four, possibly five if you count a youth team player called Jaden Richardson, right backs. McKenna, I'm sure this has been in the works for slightly longer than that, but it just feels like, you know, having been beasted by Kiefer Moore at the weekend, someone's gone, okay, well, we'd probably need a big muscular centre half in to solve that problem. And it just sort of seems to sum up the short-termist thinking at Forest. I know that's not really the answer to the question you asked, but you know, you open the floodgates with Forest and all this comes out.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about Forest anymore. Goodbye, Nick. Okay, the final game we'll focus on in the Championship was the Friday night fixture between Coventry and Queen's Park Rangers. Cov won it 3-2. We'll get to that soon enough. First, though, players from both sides didn't take a knee pre-match. It didn't happen in the Norwich-Preston game, nor in the majority of League One and Two matches either. David Ornstein's written about this in his Monday column for The Athletic. Clubs citing a lack of guidance from the EFL, who say it's up to the clubs to decide on a match-to-match basis whether they do it or not. A Rangers director of football, Les Ferdinand, has had this to say on the matter. The taking of the knee has reached a point of good PR, but little more than that. The message has been lost. It's now not dissimilar to a fancy hashtag. Taking the knee will not bring about change in the game. Actions will. Flo, you're a QPR fan. What's your take on Ferdinand's comments and Rangers' actions?
Well, my take on the comments, I fully stand by and trust the club in this. I am disappointed that they did stop doing it. They stopped doing it in July, as did a few other clubs, but because it wasn't in front of the telly, no one really picked up on it apart from one red top newspaper or tabloid that decided to write a lot about it. But as a fan, I'm disappointed in what the club have done, because although actions do speak louder than words, and I truly believe that, and I think the Premier League's, you know, no room for racism banner is completely pointless, you can see in what the club has been doing in the community, whether it's about integration, inclusivity and anti-racist work. It's there. And I think the club, you know, has a very diverse workforce, but having a diverse workforce and engaging in anti-racism are not one and the same. And I don't want the club to go down the route of like using that as a bit of a shield. I think the reason I think it's still really important to do it is that the whole point of it is to bring awareness. Yes, it is only symbolic, and that's the very nature of the issue. And Les's words are so strong because he's saying, you know, we've got to do this and more. Don't just take the knee if you're not following up with any actions. And he references what happened to the club's youth team in Spain when they reported some racism to UEFA and still nothing's been done about it. So I can understand he's really frustrated and he feels like it's a hollow gesture. So why carry on? But I do think I'm disappointed because the whole point is about bringing awareness. And I don't think that you should need a directive in order to do it. I think you should keep doing it until something changes. And, you know, I know Les will think, well, that's, you know, unlikely to happen anytime soon. But I think you need to keep the message going. And perhaps there needs to be an alternative thing that clubs can do, because it's getting awkward if you're both going to the referee's office and sort of staring at each other, waiting to see who's going to be the first to not want to do it. So I feel I'm in two minds about it, because I was frustrated because I want the club to be taking part in these important messages. But at the same time, they're a club that you can really trust when they do say their actions are louder than words.
Adrian, lest we forget, there was a football match as well, and Coventry came out on the right side of the five-goal thriller. We've been sort of saying that we think they'll be okay this season, and this was an important result for them just to get off and underway and looking like they are going to be able to compete at this level.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident they're going to be fine this season, Coventry. I was banging the drum last season from a pretty early stage, and I think that they just continue to get better. This was a good performance. Callum O'Hare was really exciting. He's definitely championship ready. He was a breath of fresh air. I thought the two wingbacks were terrific. Dabo and Giles. Hamer in central midfield has made a good impact. He's kind of replaced Walsh there, from who they had on loan from Bristol City's, and he had a really good influence on the game in the second half. And behind them, you've got a back three that was really solid. It's one of the best in, well, it was the best in League One last season. And Rose isn't even playing at the moment. He's just coming back from injury. So yeah, Coventry were good in this game. I thought QPR were flimsy at the back, I have to say. Barbe was poor. I thought that in the air, he's a little bit of a liability. And I know that the manager, Warburton, because I interviewed him not so long ago on the radio, I said, what's going to be different then in terms of QPR? You let in so many goals last season. Great to watch. But how are you going to arrest that sort of leakiness? And I respect Mark. He speaks very nicely. He basically pinned it on Barbe's injury. And for me, I just think he's a left back or a left sided centre back in a three. He's not dominant. And in this game, he wasn't good, in my opinion. So I think that they need to reinforce at centre half moving forwards, Queen's Park Rangers.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same old issues. And I think the fans are getting a bit sick and tired of it, to be honest, because the club have obviously spent a bit of money to get Rob Dickey in. And you can't expect that to change overnight, but it is a little bit tiresome when it's the same problems. Cannot defend at a set piece, completely all over the place at times when they lose the ball. And yes, when you play high fullbacks, that's a nature of the risk that you take. But at the same time, you know, Lee Wallace is an experienced defender.
Yeah.
He's not quick,
yeah, he was poor, wasn't he?
Yeah, he should know what he's doing. And I think for me, what I get so frustrated about is the lack of doing the basics. And in an interview with one of the fan blogs, Love for Words, who's a big QPR blogger this season, Mark Warburton hinted at the fact that the players are actually getting fined for conceding goals at set pieces. And Clive from Love for Words made a joke saying, oh, their overdraft must look as bad as mine then. And that is the thing. It's this complete lack of kind of being switched on. And I don't think Barbe is good enough. I completely agree. And the whole thing about having a left-sided centre-back who's left-footed, I mean, I don't see how that can be enough of a pull to play him every single game when the same things are going wrong, with the hope that one day he'll play an incredible pass, you know, that will make it worth it and worth the risk. So there's still so much to sort out, and it's just becoming deja vu. And although the team have shown that they can score goals even without Eze on the pitch, you do think it's just, you know, when will there be a bit of progression on that front?
Throwing out barbets all over the place today. Right, depending on the platform you're listening via, you'll now either hear an advert or a brief musical interlude, after which we'll discuss League One stuff.
Everyone remembers that time you've had that peach of an accumulator looking good only for, oh, and the keeper's let it slip through his legs in the 94th minute. Or the right back has to pull on the gloves and face a penalty. Or Man United have again conceded a late equaliser. But with Paddy Power's Acca Cracker, you get a free bet if one leg of your fourfold plus Acca lets you down on all football matches and all markets. Paddy Power. Max free bet £10. Minimum odds of 1 to 5 on each leg. Online exclusive. Exclude shop bets. T's and C's apply. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic. This is the Totally Football League Show with Matt Davis-Adams.
League One headlines. The Athletic reports that Wigan Athletic's administrators have rejected a second bid of £3.3 million for the club from ex-Port Vale owner Norman Smurthwaite. Supporters were back at Charlton, Blackpool and Shrewsbury. Sadly, it only went well for Blackpool, with the other sides losing. Charlton's latest prospective owner, Thomas Sandgaard, was another person present at the Valley on Saturday. There were some Sunderland fans at the Kassam, in the car park at least. And meanwhile, Ipswich, Lincoln and Hull are the league's 100%ers. Only one place we can start, though, not just because two of our panellists were there. An eight-goal thriller at the Kayan Prince Foundation Stadium between Wimbledon and Plymouth, who drew 4-4.
Two substitutes have both come on and scored. It's 4-4 now. Anybody's game this. First of all, Niall Canavan turning in a header from a corner. And then Dominic Telford volleying in completely unmarked in the penalty area.
Simon, we seem to be saying this a lot lately, but this feels like it was a real pity that there were no supporters in the ground to witness it. It must have been incredible to see live.
Oh, 100%. I mean, it was a weird experience from the very beginning, really. It's the first football match I've attended since February, which seems like a lifetime ago now, and sort of summed up with a moment of light comedy from the local radio commentator before the game, who warned some unsuspecting reporter as he went to sit down in front of him before the game that I wouldn't sit there, mate. I tend to spit a little bit when I get quite excited in my commentary, which...
That wasn't me, by the way. I was the local radio, but that was the Devon lot. It wasn't me.
I can confirm that wasn't you. That was the Devon lot. But that sort of turned my stomach a little bit. And it's a good job he did move with the eight goals. And I tell you what, it could have been eight all. And not just four all, which I don't think I've been racking my brains. I'm pretty sure I'd remember it if I had. I don't think I've ever seen a four all before. And not just four all. But the quality of the goals, it was just incredible. It was an incredible afternoon. But yeah, you're right. You still leave the ground with that slightly deflated feeling of, you know, how amazing this would have just been with supporters here. And I went to the toilet at half time and there was a little sign up for the Cheltenham Festival back in March, which shows how long it's been since they've kind of taken the posters down inside the stadium back in March. So, yeah, it was an anti-climax and just a very weird afternoon, really, because, you know, Wimbledon again playing at a different venue and, you know, the way the match swung one way and another and the scoreline as well.
Yeah, pretty amazing. And I tend to spit a bit. Not a sentence you want to hear in 2020 from anybody who's not in the rap game. Flo, Simon's right. There were some pretty sensational goals. Was there any one or any player in particular who stood out for you?
George Cooper from Plymouth really stood out to me. He was on loan last season. He's now made the move permanent. He scored a really good goal, Plymouth's first goal, which was one of those sort of could have been a cross, could have been a shot ones. But as well as that, he just played a part really in all Plymouth's goals. And I thought he was really impressive. Joe Pickett, who scored two for Wimbledon, has got two assists already this season, now two goals. He scored a really good free kick. Conor Grant's goal for Plymouth was really good. Yeah, like Simon said, the quality was so good. And I think it was a really good advert for League One, because I think sometimes League One and League Two get some unfair criticism. And there's some really good players in this league. And I'm also really excited for Wimbledon fans, because it's a good sign for when that move does come. Because I covered them a fair bit last season and there were some really rubbish games. And I think fans were a bit frustrated at how bad the team were at times and the lack of energy and excitement. But I think some of the players they brought in are really exciting. Ryan Longman, 19, on loan from Brighton, scored his first goal at the weekend. And I think he's someone the fans can get really excited about, albeit just a loan. But Nessa Guinness-Walker, who's always a bit unpredictable, but played well on the weekend. So I think they're going to be a bit like QPR, to be honest. So it's two teams that I have to cover and tear my hair out about how much they concede. But they're a little bit all over the place at the back. But going forward, they're really exciting to watch. So I think it's going to be great when they get into Plough Lane and the team can get behind them.
There was another quite comical moment during the game as well. I don't know if you saw this, Flo, but you know, Trevor Kettle, the referee, we've all got our own Trevor Kettle stories, having watched games down the years, but somehow he managed to walk in front of Joe Piggott after blowing the whistle for him to take that free kick. So Joe Piggott, kind of like a couple of steps into his run-up, had to sort of step back and wait for Trevor Kettle to move out of his way, and yet he still bent it over the wall and put it into the top corner, which, you know, if you watch it, you'll see it was just quite incredible, really.
Easy to stay on the boil when you're next to a kettle, I suppose.
Charlton 1, Doncaster 3. Now, offside ruler and BBC final score reporter Lindsay Hooper was at the Valley on Saturday. Earlier, producer Abby caught up with her to get her take on football with fans.
Lindsay, it was your first match back with the fans. How did it go for you? How was it?
I loved it. I loved seeing fans back in the stadium, and it felt really strange because you wonder how much noise 1,000 fans can generate. I can't say that I managed to hear too much throughout the match because Charlton didn't actually go on to win. They lost 3-1, so I didn't hear them in full voice very often. But when the players ran out of the tunnel originally, and when all the team names were being called out over the PA, I was really surprised. It really got the hairs on the back of my neck stood up again, because you just realise how much you've missed them. And they grouped the fans together more than I thought they were going to at the Valley. They had them in the lower stand of the north stand, and just directly below where the press box was. So you actually heard the noise really well from where we were sat. And I think during a couple of the reports and updates that I did on the BBC, you could actually hear the fans in the background, which was lovely to hear for a change after 6 months' absence.
Not fake noise anymore. Yeah, it's interesting how different clubs are going around this. I don't know whether they've been tasked with putting fans in different areas, but looking at Bloomfield Road for Blackpool, the fans were sort of spread around across the stadium. And I know in Scotland, they've also gone with the Charlton and the Blackpool methods. So interesting that different styles going with different stadiums. What were Charlton's protocols that you noted?
Well, they divided the way that you got to the stadium. Press and media and staff for the club had one entrance and fans had a completely different one. So you were sent in advance a lot of information that you had to digest. You had to make sure you went to that correct gate. And that's where you had your temperature check and your COVID form, and you were given all the information that you needed. But fans were kept completely separate from the staff and the media, and I think that was really important. They had their own temperature check. They were asked to socially distance in families and groups that way, because of course there was also the announcement of not having people in groups of six or more. So I did witness the way that everyone was socially distancing to queue to get into the stadium. It was a much slower process. I think that's worth pointing out. You know, when we do start to see more and more fans returning to stadiums, you're going to have to allow more time to get in. But you have to give credit to the football clubs that are doing their utmost to try and get fans back in stadiums. But it means more cleaning time. It does mean when it comes to opening toilets and one-way systems around concourses, that has to be adhered to. So it is going to take a bit longer. But I thought that for this experiment, it worked really, really well. And as I was exiting the stadium, which I had to exit a different exit to everybody else as well, there was a constant flow of fans coming out of the stadium, but they were in a tiered approach. Everyone wasn't allowed to just exit altogether. And that is the way that they're going to have to approach this, I think.
So top tips, if you're a fan attending a match, give it 5 hours before you get in.
Yeah, maybe not quite 5 hours, but certainly allow extra time. Don't be that lastminute.com person. We all know them. You're definitely going to have to allow a little bit more time. Make sure you've got your mask. It doesn't hurt as well to have your own anti-bac with you as well. I mean, the club have got them, but this, of course, for lower league clubs especially, it's an extra expense. So if you can save them some costs, it is going to help them.
Amazing. Well, it's nice to be talking about Charlton in a different light to the usual takeover chat. Thank you very much, Lindsay.
That'll be for next week. All right.
Lindsay Hooper of the offside rule there. Adrian, before we move on from this game, briefly, Arsenal loanee Tyrese John-Jules hit a great goal in the match. Tell us a little bit about him, please.
Oh, what a goal it was. Just a real twinkle toes inside the box. Lovely little finish and great way to get off the mark in Donny colours. This is a big loan for Tyrese John-Jules. He's been involved in the first team during pre-season and scored goals, actually, and looked as if he can handle himself. I think he went away to Lincoln last season, scored one in seven appearances, so did okay, but nothing major, then got injured. So this is his opportunity with Doncaster to really make a big impression. He's still only 19, so there's time on his side. He's a very talented boy. And do you know what? I think he's at the right club at the moment. They're a pretty vibrant team. They're attack-minded, Doncaster, very good midfield unit behind him of Whiteman and Magic Gomez, and then ahead of them in the 10 role, Taylor Richards, who's on loan. So he's got good footballers around him to supply the ammunition. So yeah, I can see John-Jules kicking on from that performance at the Valley and grabbing quite a few goals for Donny over the coming months.
The second loan is always, I always think, the key loan for a young player, isn't it? That first one, you can give them the benefit of the doubt of finding their feet in men's football, but that second loan is where you really have to earn your colours. And of course, there's one amazing fact attributed to Tyrese John-Jules, which I'm sure you may have discussed on this programme already, but do you know what it is?
Is it about his uncle?
Yeah, it is about his uncle. So you've obviously heard that one before. We completely stole my thunder there. His uncle is Danny John-Jules, who was Cat in Red Dwarf, which when I looked that up at the weekend, made my day.
Let's go to Peterborough next. They beat Fleetwood by 2-1. If Ian McIntosh was still in this chair, he would be praising Thunder Bastards from Callum Camps for Fleetwood and Jack Taylor for Posh. Posh scoring twice in stoppage time to win from behind. And Flo, I feel like that's a big result for them. Some positivity around the place after their stumble on opening day and also the bitter end to last season.
Yeah, I think I hate that sort of, you know, hangover word that a lot of clubs seem to be facing with the end of last season and the playoffs. But I think probably there is a little bit of that at Peterborough, a bit of frustration about how things ended. And they are one of the favourites, so it's important that they get up and running. And yet again, we're talking about, oh, what a shame it was that no fans were there, because 2 goals in stoppage time, those are always the most memorable games at home in front of the fans. So an important win because it shows a bit of fight. It shows that they're up for the challenge, and maybe fans had been a little bit worried this season because perhaps they were still sulking a little bit about what happened. And against another team who's, you know, one of the favourites as well, especially for the playoffs this season. So a really, really good win.
Yeah, I'm confident, Matt, that these two teams will be in the top six. I think they're really strong. Peterborough, loads of talent, but there's a better balance maybe to the side now, and less reliance on Ivan Toney. So yeah, I think once they find their flow, Peterborough will win a lot more than they lose. And Fleetwood are going to be one of the toughest teams to beat in the division. Joe Barton, I think, is doing a great job as the head coach. Love him or loathe him, he's a good manager, I think, and they're going places under his tenure. So yeah, watch these two teams. That could turn out to be a huge result come May, I think.
Simon, you're this week's Oxford correspondent, so we ought to talk about the U's with you. 2 defeats on the spin to start the campaign. Are you taking that fabled playoff hangover excuse that Flo doesn't like, but Robin Cowan employed so effectively last week?
Yeah, I don't believe it in hangovers in terms of Oxford's season. They had a good pre-season. If you can look into that, they put in some good performance against higher league opposition. No, I think It's pretty simple, really. Oxford, number one, they've got a lot of injuries, which, you know, Northampton with 10 players missing went and won at Shrewsbury, so that's not an excuse. But for me, the most alarming thing, and this is what worries me as a fan, because with only one senior signing left within their cap, we desperately need an experienced centre-back, and we desperately need some pace out wide. And two positions, if we don't fill both of those with the kind of quality we need, I think we're really lacking in, certainly in leadership out there. Because you talk about Fleetwood and Peterborough, you know, Fleetwood have got an abundance of experience through their squad. We just don't have that. Jamie Mackey retired in the summer. John Massino's got more of a coaching role this year, and beside that, he's injured now as well. You know, our two centre-backs are very young, talented players, Elliot Moore and Rob Atkinson. People are talking about Atkinson going even further than Rob Dickey, maybe, but playing them as a two together with no real Football League experience, you know, beyond the last year, I just think that there's a little bit of an imbalance within our squad at the minute, and Cole Robinson's identified it. But when you're working within a salary cap now, you can't just go and buy two or three experienced players, because you've got to keep below that $2.5 million.
Sure do. Right, one more stop on the fun bus that is this podcast. League Two, we come in.
This is the Totally Football League Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
League Two headlines. Ian Everett becomes the first Bolton manager to lose their first four matches since 1887. Clarkie went through every Bolton match report ever to find that stat. Cambridge are goal happy. They're 8-0 up after two matches. And Forest Green and Carlisle hosted supporters at the weekend. Clarkie, you had a look at Exeter 0, Port Vale 2 for us. Port Vale, well-run, seemingly happy club with a good manager. It's a club that seems like it's going places at the moment.
It's really going well for Port Vale. They've got the look of a team that are on the rise, that's for sure. We saw signs of that last season before the season was curtailed early. And yeah, they may well have snuck into the playoffs a little bit like Northampton did. So yeah, watch out for Port Vale. Scored one good goal on the counter-attack here. There was a great curling free kick from Conlon as well. Devontae Rodney has come in, I think from Salford, and has looked ever so sharp. So yeah, it looks like a well balanced team, and I would expect them to be knocking on the door. For Exeter, it's no disaster. That's their first home defeat in a year. They're very, very strong on home turf. I think from their point of view, they need to kind of get to the bottom of Randale Williams, the right wing back, key man for them last year. I believe he rejected a move to Hull. He's got some irons in another fire, and I just think that might just drag on a little bit and distract, you know, someone that's really, really important for Exeter in the coming weeks. So hopefully they can get that business done and move on and build for this season.
Leighton Orient 2, Mansfield 2. Mansfield managing their first goals of the season, but still yet to win in the league. Flo, I just wonder, after a fairly underwhelming start and a lot of money spent, if Graham Coughlan might be under pressure before too long. We know Mansfield have got a big budget and they make no bones about that, but they'll be expecting a bit more of a return than they've had so far.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this result, all I could really think about was Orion and this amazing start to the season and kind of dream situation with the cup tie, which obviously we mentioned earlier. Who knows what's going to happen there, which is a real shame, but it will probably be rescheduled or something, ideally, in a couple of weeks. So for me, I kind of focus more on them in this, because they're just showing so much confidence, arrogance, desire, and the feeling about the around the place must be so good right now. Danny Johnson scoring again, DJ loving life. I just think, yeah, I'm really excited for Orient this season, and as obviously working in and around kind of the London football scene, there's so many good London clubs at the moment. It's great for Orient to be part of that conversation as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Grimsby 0, Salford 4, Simon. I think Ian Henderson did well, A, to get a hat-trick, but B, to bury those two penalties with somebody blasting an air horn just at the moment that he struck the ball.
That was incredible, wasn't it?
Now Henderson against James McEwen. Already scored a penalty two weekends ago against Rotherham. What will he do here? Sends it down the middle, a confident player again. So does he go the same way, or does he try something different? So it's the versatile, the way he's taking penalties. staggered run-up. He goes similar just to the right of centre and double Salford City's lead here at Blundell Park.
He's already looking like a really good buy, though, isn't he? We thought that he'd hit the ground running after coming in from Rochdale, and he's certainly done that.
Yeah, I think this could be one of the signings of the season, really. I mean, he's 36 in January. Salford are the League Two Galacticos. He's got more goals in the EFL since 2011 than any other player. But you look at his record in League One as well, in a team that predominantly Rochdale, you know, are struggling in League One to stay up. Let's be honest. You know, 16 goals last season, 21, 20, 19 in the last 4 years as well. He's not even what you would call an out-and-out striker, but such a clever player. And I think surrounded by good players who are going to create opportunities, and the fact that he takes good penalties as well. This is a Salford side who, you know, I feel sorry for Grimsby because they've had a lot of changes this summer with Ian Holloway, you know, really revamping their squad, and that was an absolute beating after losing their first game of the season as well. But, you know, Salford, I think most people would look at them as one of the favourites for promotion. Drew way too many games last year, but after finding their feet last season and getting to a Wembley final as well before not being able to play that game, I think this year will be the year, you know, that they really are up there again, and they will be backed come what may.
That's just about it for this week. Before we go, time for our never tenuous and finally section. This week, inspired by Brentford's happy housewarming at the Brentford Community Stadium, I want to know, what's the best way to get settled quickly in a new gaff? Now, Simon, I've got some insider knowledge here. You have got a bar in your garage. Was that something that you always had in mind when you moved into your current abode to get you feeling settled?
Yeah, well, it was a lockdown idea that just started off as a darts board and then progressed as the months went on and became a little bit of an obsession after that, that, you know, my wife has just given up on trying to suppress, to be honest. So she's probably quite glad to get rid of me to the garage for a few hours every evening to play darts. But yeah, on that note, I think particularly with fans coming back in small numbers this weekend, a house party, a housewarming party. I mean, it's great to see Brentford at their new stadium. It looks fantastic, but how brilliant it will be to have fans inside the stadium filling those seats and having a real party, particularly as they didn't get to celebrate their send-off at Griffin Park as they would have loved to have done.
Yeah, absolutely. Clarkie, how about you? Best way to get settled quickly in a new house?
Well, I moved into this house that I'm in now 3 years ago, and it just brought back memories when you brought this up, because I just think the best way to settle into your new home, especially when you've got brand new carpets, is to spill an entire plate of curry all over the carpet, and then just to stain it, just to mark it up a little bit. It's like when you get a new pair of trainers, isn't it? It doesn't feel real until they've got their first scuff. So yeah, my advice to Brentford was just get a few stains in and around that stadium, mess it up a bit, and then you'll start to feel a little bit more at home. I was in the bad books for about a week after doing that. It was an absolutely shocking start.
Quite right too. How about you, Flo? Are you getting your QPR duvet and pillow set out as soon as you get in?
Oh, you know what? I did actually have that, but then my boyfriend banned me from using that because I think he thought it was the only thing, you know, something a 13-year-old boy would do. No, my thing would be walk around naked, or if you don't want to be naked, in your pants, and really, you know, mark your territory and get a feel for the surroundings. I think that's the biggest thing. When you feel like you know, you're really comfortable in your own home and you can really relax, I think that's the
essential. How do you mark your territory, by the way?
I was just going to say, don't do it like Clarkie.
No, not like an animal would, but you know, the proverbial territory that one might mark, you know, swagger about the place in your underwear. That's what I would say.
Nice. That's a great way to end a very assured debut, Flo. We'll see you again soon, hopefully. And you too, Simon. Thanks for joining us. Clarkie, 8 out of 10, as ever. That's just about it for this week. From Adrian, Flo, Simon, Abby and me, have a smashing week. We'll catch up with you soon.
You've been listening to the Totally Football League Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and following at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all the Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football League Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Muddy Knees Media.
Yes, that music means one thing and one thing only. The Offside Rule WSL edition is back. Woohoo! And the WSL is bigger and better than ever before, which means we need to do the same. And that's why we've got interviews with the biggest names, the brightest minds in the game, as well as all the in-depth match analysis you've come to know and love. Just search for the Offside Rule WSL edition, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can find us ad-free on the Athletic app. That's the Offside Rule WSL edition, out every Tuesday.